Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Been in a series on Mondays for the last few months, where we're going through the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, on the four foundations of mindfulness. And we're in the fourth foundation. We're on the, third or fourth aspect of the fourth foundation. I know it sounds like a lot, but once you listen to it for a while, you're like, okay, there's all of these different sections. And the Buddha's teachings were very detailed, in depth. Everything was included. Then he explained how to be mindful of every different part of our human experience. The section tonight is mindfulness of the six sense doors, mindfulness of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling, bodily sensations, and mindfulness of thoughts of the mind, all six. Or mindfulness of the eye, the ear, the tongue, the nose, the body, and the mind. So I'm trying to think of I like to start by asking you to talk to each other for a moment about your experience with some of this. So reflecting for a moment on, I guess first the question is like, do you use the sense doors as a mindfulness practice? Like sometimes just be like seeing, mindfulness of seeing. Seeing is like this. And bringing mindfulness to not only what you're seeing, but also whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, the feeling tone of what you're seeing. Or hearing. I think it's very important that this is part of the mindfulness instructions, because often people hear the first instruction, which is be mindful of your breath. And we also, many of us, I think a lot of people bring to meditation the idea that it's supposed to be stillness, or that it's supposed to be peaceful. Or you ever feel like you're getting distracted by sound in your meditation? Like you ever get angry of like, shut the fuck up, I'm meditating, and you want like the world to shut up. And you think like those sounds are distracting me. But part of this teaching is that sound cannot be a distraction, because it's just another thing to be mindful of. There's ultimately, when we look at the full teachings of mindfulness, if you're practicing present time awareness, whatever's happening, whatever sense door is stimulated, sounds, smells, tastes, images, it's all part of, you're just mindful of it, present with it, non-judgmental awareness of right now I'm hearing or smelling or tasting or feeling sensations in the body. Likewise, no matter how uncomfortable you get in meditation, sitting here and your ass hurts and your knees hurt and your back hurts or whatever, really a lot of discomfort, it's not a distraction. It's just what's happening. Oh, sensation in my body. Unpleasant sensation, burning, stabbing, tearing, and then our relationship to it. But the idea that meditation is supposed to be quiet and comfortable and, you're supposed to feel calm and pleasant in it all of the time is not how the Buddha taught. Like maybe there are forms of meditation where, you want to listen to the pleasant music and you want to take a little nap, but that's not Buddhist mindfulness. Buddhist mindfulness is like, what's happening? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? What's happening at the eye awareness? What's happening at the ears, at the nose, at the tongue? What's happening in your body, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? What's happening in your mind? Not trying to stop thoughts, but be aware of the impermanent nature of thoughts. I don't know how to frame this. When you think about your six senses, your eyes, nose, tongue, ears, the body. The body is such a big sense door, right? It's like just seeing and hearing, and then all of the sensations head to toe. So much going on in our physical bodies. It's such a big, we call them doorways. There's such a, so much physically going on. Or the mind, so much going on in our minds. What do you feel like is most difficult for you to be mindful of? Do you not really think of as an object of meditation? Is it your thoughts? Is it seeing? Usually when our eyes are open, we're just like looking around and kind of, you know, judging and comparing and doing whatever we're doing when we're, our eyes are open. But seeing as a meditation, just seeing, seeing people, seeing things, seeing, seeing the four elements in whatever configuration, and knowing everything that I see is the four elements. Everything that I see is a process of impermanence. Everything that I see, the mind and you know, eye consciousness almost instantly classifies as that's pleasant to look at, pleasant to see, unpleasant to see, or perhaps neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. What do you feel like for you is the most challenging part of like trying to stay present? Is it in listening? Is it in seeing? Is it in smelling? Knowing that you're smelling? Is it in tasting? Mindful eating, really being present with what you're tasting, with what we're putting into our mouths, what we're chewing, what we're savoring, swallowing. Or is it discomfort? So many of us feel like, well, it's so hard to, it's easy to be mindful when we're comfortable, but when there's physical discomfort, there's that instinctual aversion, hard to just rest in awareness, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness of pain. What do you feel like if you, some of you are maybe a little too new to meditation to have a clear answer to this yet, but this is part of the terrain. One of the things about coming to this class or meditation classes is that sometimes it's going to show you where you've been. Sometimes it's going to show you where you're going. It's kind of like, oh, here's some instructions I haven't quite explored yet. I haven't really been looking at eye consciousness or ear consciousness. I've just been trying to pay attention to my breath so far. But the Buddha expands beyond breath awareness to all of the sense doors, the whole body. And we're going to talk about that tonight and meditate on it. So find two or three people in the room, or I'm going to put you guys in breakout rooms that you don't know yet so that you meet some people. Part of the function of this is so that you build community and you meet some new people in the group. So find two or three people and talk about mindfulness of the sense doors. What are, you know, are you trying to do it? Is this an, is this new information or is this part of your practice already? And I'll open the groups at home. Breakout rooms coming. So the simple way to practice this aspect of mindfulness is knowing that you're seeing, being aware this is sight, knowing that it's sound, smell, taste, sensation, knowing, being aware that the three characteristics apply to everything that we're hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking, the three characteristics of reality is the truth of impermanence, that whatever we're hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting is arising and passing. It's changing. It's impermanent. It's not, even though some things look very permanent, like, you know, you look at a wall, you can't quite see the impermanence of the wall. It looks so solid and so permanent, but in the long run, you know, you've all seen ruins. What happens in the long run, that there's a slow decay that happens and we're not always seeing it, but it's happening. Everything's impermanent. The truth of impermanence of all of the phenomena of the sense doors also makes everything that we're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking unreliable. As a source of permanent happiness. You can never, you know, nothing's gonna last long enough to really provide permanent happiness. So no matter how beautiful it is, you ever have that experience where you get something new and it's so awesome, like the new painting or the new carpet or the new clothing or the new car, whatever it is. And you're so excited about it. And then after a while, it just becomes ordinary because you've been looking at it for years. And it's not like it you know, gave you some temporary satisfaction and happiness, maybe even still love it a decade down the road, but it's not that excitement that it was when you first got it. I remember when I was moving to the West Side I lived on the East Side for a long time, and I always liked the West Side. I can remember coming over here and then moving over here and being like, oh yeah, I'm fucking cruising through Venice. This is so cool and excited about it. And then, you know, and I was like, I know that this isn't going to last. And pretty soon it's just going to be my neighborhood. But when you first come to the neighborhood, it was like so exciting to first be in the neighborhood. And then after a while, it's just like, yeah, it's my name. Now I go to the East Side. I'm like, oh, fucking the East Side is so cool. Like that novelty, like what's different than what we're used to, what we're accustomed to. So the unreliable nature. And then the third characteristic, and this teaching points to it quite a bit, is coming to that ultimate wisdom that there's not a self that is experiencing it, that it's not personal, that there's not the belief in a permanent I, me, and mine is what's called a fetter. So in this instruction, they say, you know, bring mindfulness to seeing and the fetters that arise around seeing. And so the fetter of self, of I am seeing, and most of the time we believe our eyes, right? Like this is me looking at the world, right? Or this is me hearing. And that belief in a permanent self is one of the things that we're trying to investigate and to eventually kind of not be so identified with, and start to understand that the ear hears all by itself, and there's not really a self, a consciousness that is permanent receiver of the hearing. The eye sees all by itself, the tongue tastes, the nose smells, the body feels. But in meditation, part of our task is to unpack and investigate, well, where is the witness? Where is the I, the me, the mind? I think last week and the last couple of weeks we've been on this track because it's a core part of this teaching, the impersonal nature of things, one of the three characteristics. So the three characteristics are everything's impermanent, everything's unsatisfactory, unreliable due to impermanence, and there is not a permanent self to be found as the owner of these experiences. You can look, and we're looking, but anything that the mind says, that's me, I am the owner of this experience. It's all just a process. It's all impermanent process. In the instructions here from the suttas, the way the monks chant it, as they say, one dwells contemplating the phenomena in phenomena in terms of the six internal and external sense bases. And here one understands the I, one understands forms and understands the fetter that arises in relationship to the I. So the fetter, I'll give you a few different definitions of fetter. Fetter means, well, you know the term fetter? It means like handcuffs. It means shackles, fetters, shackles. That which binds us to suffering is the way that it's being used. A fetter in Buddhism is that which is you're hooked in, you're locked up, you're shackled or handcuffed or fettered to something that is causing you suffering. And part of the whole Buddhist perspective of liberation is when you're no longer fettered. You're no longer handcuffed. You're no longer shackled to ignorance or to self-centeredness or to that is creating suffering in your life. Your part of liberation is being unfettered. A few different lists of 10, there's 10 fetters traditionally, 10 things that we get hooked into. This list says sensual lust, anger, conceit, views, like views and opinions, doubt, attachment to rites and rituals, which is like blind faith in religious rites and rituals, attachment to like, I'm a fucking Buddhist and I'm the best Buddhist and I'm really attached to my beads or my fucking Dharma Punks t-shirt or whatever it is. Like I'm attached to it. Lust for existence, jealousy, greed, ignorance. So that's one list of 10 different kinds of fetters. And do you hear the instruction is be aware of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, and how those are creating fetters. The eye of lusting with the eye, or doubt, or with sound. And you know how sometimes you hear something and you're just like instantly aversive to that sound. The fetter of anger. Oh, fucking turn that shit off. You know? And being mindful of, okay, there was sound and then there was anger. Anger arose in relationship. And really it was just sound. It was I found it unpleasant, my perception. And then I met it, or there's something really beautiful. Turn that shit up. Lust, more, play it again. And that kind of the fetter of lusting and attachment and craving that comes from the sound or the sight or the smell or the taste. You know, you taste something like that shit's delicious. I'm full, but I'm going to keep eating because that shit is delicious. And that lust for the pleasant sensation of ice cream or whatever it is that your hot sauce, whatever you love. Mindfulness of the sense door, how we're getting input, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and how is that causing suffering? What's the fetter? What's the lack of wisdom that we're meeting the seeing, smelling, tasting with? The other, more traditional 10 fetters is belief in self, the first identity. Sometimes it's talked about as, I think the term is Sakya deity, which is the view that I am my personality. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I am Noah, and Noah is like this, and this is who I am, and not holding our sense of self like a loose garment, like roles that we play, but really believing like I am this mind, this body, this personality, and taking it all quite personally. The second traditional one is doubt. And it's doubt in the possibility of liberation. Sometimes it's talked about like doubt in the Buddha or the Buddhism or the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. Not believing your own capacity for awakening, or that awakening is even a thing, even possible. Kind of just being identified with everyone's suffering. It's not possible to not suffer, or maybe, you know, suffering's not that big of a deal. Attachment to the rites and rituals, sensual lust, ill will, anger. And then the there's four, which are called higher levels. That, you know, so there's those first five. And then the second five, first five, belief in self, doubt, attachment to religious norms, sense, desire, ill will. And then there's material desire for rebirth, that kind of, I want to be reborn in a pleasant realm. And that sort of craving for rebirth to be true and, you know, or the desire, the craving to be for an immaterial rebirth, to kind of say like, I don't want to come back to this realm. I want to be in the heaven realms, or I want to go to craving for nirvana. And I want to kind of not, you know, kind of go to whatever that is. Conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. The 10th fetter, I heard one of my teachers say, part of that ignorance, the way that it's talked about there, one of the last fetters, because that's like the highest, like we are becoming a Buddha, an Arahant. He said, it's that feeling that we all have, which is looking forward to something. The ignorance of thinking something else is going to be better than this. And that it's the last thing to go. Like, you can be almost enlightened. You can be really, but that the mind keeps doing that grass is greener. Like, this is pretty good, but I'm really looking forward to doing something other than what I'm doing right now. And that at liberation, there's that experience of like totally satisfied, doesn't need to be different than it is, not looking forward to anything, not missing anyone or anything. One of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, I'm always surprised, I hear him say this quite a bit. He says he's come to a place in his practice where he never misses anyone. He said, I have some really close relationships, 50-year monastic, very, you know, these really close relationships. And he said, I really enjoy when we're together, but when we're not together, I never miss them. And I'm always like, whoa, that I do not have that experience. maybe he's a sociopath, maybe he's a Buddha, I don't know. But it's part of the model of that we'll actually get to a place where we don't miss anybody because we're so fully present with what we're doing. And you know, when you see them, you're happy to see them. And maybe you make plans, but it's not out of a craving. It's not out of an idea that will be better than this. That will be better than this. Are you following me so far? Was it making sense? Well, I feel like we should meditate and then we'll explore some of the depths of this later. And in the meditation, I will try to guide you through all of the six sense doors. So there might be a lot of instructions, we'll see. But find a way to sit upright, relaxed. Settling into the first sense door of the body, mindfulness, present time awareness. Feel your body, know that you have a body. You can even investigate, how do you know you have a body? What phenomena What sensations are informing you that you are alive in a physical form? Feeling your hands, your feet, your arms, your legs. So many sensations. Contact with the chair. Cushion, the trunk of the body, the sensation of the heart beating, the lungs breathing. Feel the body with the body. And that awareness that most of the time we're probably pretty identified. This is me. This is my body. This is who I am, what I am, this physical form. Reflecting on the impermanent nature, constantly changing nature of all of the sensations. Each breath comes and goes, the heart repeatedly beating, constantly processing the blood from the veins and arteries. And shifting intentionally from body as the focus to the ear, sound. What sounds can you tune into internally? Can you hear the ringing that the ears produce? Can you hear the breath, the heartbeat? And externally, what sounds my voice coming and going? The air, the traffic outside, people's breath in the room, movement. And how far away can you hear? How wide does your hearing take your awareness? Out into the street, up Lincoln, how far can you follow that next car? The impermanent nature of sounds arising, sustaining, changing, passing. Craving for pleasant sounds, aversion to unpleasant sounds. If you can tune into that high-pitched tone that the body produces, the ringing in the ears, it can be a very interesting meditation object, just receiving the buzz, the ringing, the tone. Shifting from the investigation of the ear, hearing, to tasting, bring the mindfulness to your mouth, your tongue, even though you probably aren't eating anything, tasting anything, just taste your mouth. What's your mouth taste like? Perhaps moving your tongue around a bit, mindfulness of the tongue and the taste buds, saliva, swallowing. and shifting to the nose, smelling. Is there any sense present? Can you smell anything in your environment here in this room or wherever you're sitting? The person sitting next to you is BO, your own body. The faint smell of cleaning products. And then bringing awareness to the eyes, even meditating with the eyes closed. What is seen? What is perceived? Is there color? Is there shape? Is there light? Do you have a sense of seeing the outline of your body sitting? Now shifting to the mind state, thoughts, observing how thoughts arise and pass, even when we're just trying to investigate our experience. The thinking mind continues just as the heart beats and the lungs breathe. Plans, memories, maybe even the fetters, doubt arising in the mind or craving. Anger, fear. Worrying. Reminiscing. What's your mind up to? Thoughts arising and passing. sounds arising and passing, smell, taste, images, sensations. At this point, open, spacious, inclusive awareness of our experience and the doors of perception, how we perceive through sound, smell, taste, sensation, and thought. Nothing can distract us because this is all of the ways of knowing. Even when we get caught in a memory or a plan, it's still happening right now. That's a plan unfolding right now. It's a memory that's happening in the present. the body feels, the ears hear, the tongue tastes, the nose smells, the mind thinks and remembers and plans. Wisdom understands the impermanent, unreliable, unsatisfactory, and impersonal nature of this human condition. Nothing to cling to as I or me or mine. Don't stop being mindful as we open our eyes, as we move our bodies, seeing more sensation as we move around, being mindful in the body as you stretch or release the tension of stillness. Even looking at your mind, how does it shift as the self consciousness of like, oh shit, there's all these people, or even just looking at the screen, all the people, observing, investigating, all of these ways that we know our inner experience and we know our outer, know the world. Through seeing and hearing, smelling and tasting, by touching, physicality, and all of the mind states that we interact with, our own mind, and all of the views and opinions and judgments and comparing, and that the mind does, about each other, about and a huge part of what mindfulness, Buddhist teachings are asking us to do is to bring a sense of curiosity and investigation and a maybe a healthy skepticism to what our minds are thinking. Questioning, investigating. And, you know, and these lists of fetters are quite interesting. Like that first list of watching when the eye, ear, nose, mouth, body is experiencing craving, sensual lust, craving for sense pleasures. There's that teaching. So it's lust, anger, conceit. Conceit is, I feel like, generally thought of as like an inflated sense. Conceit, the way that I would generally use conceit would be like an inflated sense of self, conceited, egotistical. But conceit in the Buddhist perspective is just the conceit of I am. There's conceit of I am superior. There's conceit of I am inferior. You know that one? The self-centeredness of low self-esteem. I am worse than you. You are better than me. I'm unworthy. Is conceit. But then there's this mind fuck where the Buddha says there's also the conceit of equality. Which for me, I don't quite get it. I mean, I guess it what he's, because I feel like, you know, that's the goal. Like not better than, not worse than, equality. We're all in this together. There's no hierarchy of, you know, self. We're all just people fucking bumbling through together. But he says, no, even that thought of I am equal to you has too much I am in it. Too much comparing and I in it. So conceit, views and opinions, personality view, the view, DT is the term. I don't know, I think like it's interesting to look at, think about this list and imagine what would your life be like without craving for sense pleasures? If you were really just like, I'm cool. I don't need anything. How much different would your life be? How about if you didn't experience anger? If you didn't, you weren't pissed off, angry, aversive to your pain, to the ignorance and confusion in the world. You weren't meeting it with anger. You were just meeting it with compassion, not complacency, but with a loving heart, with a compassion, rather than angry. It shouldn't be like this. Compassionate about the confusion, ignorance in the world. What if we didn't have the conceit? If we weren't so attached to our views and our opinions, we had a kind of humble, it's not that you're not going to have views. Of course you have views, but not so attached to them, not shackled to your views as being right. You're like, yeah, this is what I think, but I could be wrong. I have a lot of views, but rather than like, and I'll fucking fight you and I'll suffer if you don't agree with me. And I'll try to convince you, rather than being so shackled to our views and our opinions, just being like, oh, you know, that's what makes sense to me. I could be wrong. What if, you know, you didn't have doubt? You had confidence. Your mind didn't attack you with unworthiness, and your mind didn't attack you with like doubt about, you know, your ability to recover, to awaken, to heal. Freedom from doubt, freedom from attachment to the rites and rituals, to religious beliefs. Now, maybe some of you have been practicing Buddhism enough that you can identify attachment to some Buddhist ritual. But maybe some of you are still consciously or unconscious, you know, that thing of like Catholic guilt or, you know, of the stuff you grew up with that you don't really believe, but it's still in there. There's still this part of your mind that is still suffering about the views, the rituals, the rites, the religious conditioning, the lies, basically, that we were told growing up. Freedom from that. You know, that's part of what this means. Freedom from that suffering, clinging, attachment to religious doctrine. And, you know, we can do it to ourselves in Buddhism, too. Have you done that before yet? Where you're like, you do something unskilled, you break a precept, you do something unskilled, and your Buddhist superego kicks in and is not very Buddhist. Not being very Buddhist in this argument, are you? A lot of self in here. Really fucking a lot of self in trying to be right with my views and opinions. And then, fuck, I'm a terrible Buddhist. The worst Buddhist. Lust for existence. That's just attachment. Some of this is I feel like it's not as common in our Western conditioning, but it's this lust for permanent heaven. It's like wanting to believe in heaven for a permanent existence. I want to believe that there's some realm that will be pleasant forever. I'd like to believe that I could make this realm pleasant forever, permanent existence. I don't want to die. Or if I do die, I want to like it to be this heaven, nirvana, you know, realm. Jealousy, reflecting on the fetter of jealousy. How much suffering in that, craving for something and coveting something that you don't have, someone else has. Greed, ignorance. The way that this teaching that they're doing at the monastery, where they're saying, bring mindfulness to your eye and understand the fetter that arises. Bring mindfulness to your ear and understand the fetter, the greed, the hatred, the delusion, the self, the conceit that arises when we hear a sound, when we see something, when we smell something, when we taste something, when the body has a sensation, when the mind has a thought. Be mindful of what's happening and how are you getting hooked? How is what's happening all by itself, the fetter that arises, dependent on sound, dependent on smell, dependent on taste, dependent on sensation, dependent on thoughts and emotions. And the way I hear it is there's no blame in it. It's saying this just bring mindfulness to how this happens all by itself. The fetter that arises when you hear, when you see, when you smell, when you taste, when you think. Greed, hatred, and a delusion. Self-centeredness and views and opinions, they're just happening all by themselves. Not your fault. No blame, no shame, no, you know, judgment. But we can bring awareness to it and start to get unhooked from it. I was trying to think of, because fetter, shackle, handcuff, it sounds so fucking ball and chain. It's so like so... it's so sturdy. It's so like hard to break. Like, ooh, can I break out of these handcuffs, out of these fetters, out of these shackles? Some of you have probably heard me say that this is something that my father used to say. He used to say, my dad was a meditation teacher, one of my teachers. And he used to say, you know, the way that mindfulness and the heart practices work is it's as though we have, every time we respond with one of the fetters, greed, hatred, delusion, self-centeredness, conceit, doubt, every time that's what we're identified with, it's like a piece of rice paper that we put over our heart. And rice paper is so insubstantial, right? It's like you flick it, it's you put it in water, it dissolves. It's so insubstantial, which is why he used that image. But if you, but how many times today, how many fetters today, how many times did we bring greed, bring hatred, bring self-centeredness, you know, identify with it, and it, until it's like this thick, like, and if you get enough fucking rice paper, it'll be bulletproof. So I'm trying to use this same image for the shackles. Think of your shackles of made out of a really thick pulp, you know, not metal, not, but something that is actually dissolvable. Like you have rice paper shackles, but thick ones, right? Like you can't break them. But the way that the mindfulness works, like that image of every time you bring present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness, you start to dissolve them. You start, it's slowly, it's this process of dissolving. That image work a little bit? Every time we bring mindfulness, there's going to be, and we question this view, this opinion, this conceit, this self, I, me, mine. We question that tendency to think that things are permanent and fixed. We question it. It's this process of dissolving the fixed views, questioning, dissolving, melting, thawing. Maybe frozen is an image that, you know, we get so frozen in our views. But the Dharma, the mindfulness helps us to start melting so that, you know, it's not an ice block. It starts to, it's not ice cuffs. It starts to melt them. I really like this perspective. That although when you're new to meditation, usually you keep it simple and you're like, okay, I'm just trying to ignore my mind and pay attention to my breath, trying to see the impermanent nature of the sensations of breath. And that's an important foundational initial practice. But here we are where the Buddha expands and he says, no, not just your breath. That was just the first instruction. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue. There was the instruction, every activity of the body. So every movement, every time we're moving, walking, standing, laying down, the different postures, everything that we put into our mouth as an opportunity for mindfulness, chewing, tasting, eating meditation. Sometimes you may be, if you've been on meditation retreat, we are in silent and we do formal, intentional eating meditation. But you can take that with you to the taco stand. You know me and my tacos, present time awareness of chewing, of tasting, of smelling, bringing mindfulness into that activity. It doesn't have to be slow and pseudo spiritual to bring everything that we're hearing and seeing and smelling and tasting and feeling with the intention to, I want to try to be present with this and try to be mindful. I want to try to be mindful not only of what I'm hearing and seeing and taking in, but of the impermanent nature of it and of watching how the I, me, mind, how the lusting. There's that teaching that I gave a few weeks ago. I'll just briefly revisit it, where it's one of the first big teachings that the Buddha gives after his awakening. First, he comes to his awakening and then he teaches the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. And then he runs into this group of fire worshipers, these Hindu, Brahmanic sadhus with dreadlocks that are worshiping fire, probably smoking chillums, smoking weed and hanging about by the bonfire. And he gives them a teaching. He says, you don't need to worship the fire. Because if you just bring mindfulness, you'll see everything's on fire. It's not just out there. Your eye is on fire with craving, that fetter of craving. The eye all by itself lusts for pleasant things to look at. Your ear is on fire. The burning of greed, hatred, and delusion. The, you know, it's not like I decided I hate certain sounds. Like, what's the typical, like the nails on the chalkboard or something. It's not like I decided I hate that. Like, the body just fucking hates that sound all by itself. And then there's the conditioned, you know, music is always interesting. We can play some different types of music to our group. And, you know, some of us will be like, oh, I really like that. Ooh, that's very pleasant. And others will be like, oh, that's so unpleasant. How do you listen to Slayer? It hurts my ears. How do you listen to the Grateful Dead? It hurts my heart. Right, the conditioning around what's perceived as pleasant sounds and unpleasant sounds. And fully inclusive, and that our body is our practice, is the path. There's a lot of ideas about that people bring to like transcending, and you know, Buddhism is about descending. Come into your body. Stop leaving your. Come in to the present. Be present with the simple seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. Investigate the embodied. All of the Dharma will be revealed. All of the truth, everything that we're looking for. The end of the fetters, you know, that I'm talking about, the causes of suffering, happens through paying attention to our bodies, not through some intellectual, spiritual trip. Not some psychedelic trip, but through here, present, in the body, with what's happening, what we're smelling, what we're tasting, what we're feeling moment to moment. It is such an interesting, I guess, juxtaposition how all of the causes of suffering are right here and they're not your fault. Just take that in. Your body creates all of that suffering. Your mind creates all of that suffering without your participation. It's just what the human body and mind does. Really take that in. First noble truth, suffering. You took birth. You have a mind and a body that crave pleasure, hate pain, take everything personal. Not your fault. Your body does it all. Your body, your mind, your whatever you want to call it, does it all. And then the other thing is, the body creates all of it, the mind creates all of it, but also with the right instructions, this mind, this body, our awareness here can lead to the end of suffering. The body is the cause of suffering, the mind, body, these sense doors that have the fetters are the cause of most of our unhappiness, probably all of our unhappiness. But also, through mindfulness, this is the path to end the fetters, to end the unhappiness, to end the misidentification with I am this personality or I am these views and opinions or I am better than or I am less than or I am stuck in any way. Knowing that long-term mindfulness, long-term compassion towards pain, non-attachment towards pleasure, unpacking is all done right here in this body. You don't got to go anywhere. You don't got to, you know, you don't have to pay anybody. You don't even have to come to meditation class. You don't need a guru. You don't need a, you know, you don't really need a teacher. I mean, somebody has to give us some instructions. But it's your body, it's your practice, it's your liberation. Each one of us has to do it for ourselves. Nobody can do it for us. But, you know, we get together to remind ourselves, to support each other, to be with like-minded people who are also trying to do this radical thing in this world where it's not done that much. Not many people really trying to be present, really trying to be mindful, really trying to be non-attached, really trying to unpack the human condition and not just intellectualize it, but on the cushion in real practice. So six sense doors as mindfulness practice. We have a few minutes for questions, comments, clarifications, anything that I've talked about. Yeah, please.
This is like, for some reason, the most confusing one of this series to me. There's like so much to unpack within it, but the fetter of like the nothingness of liberation, the Buddha, like the Nirvana, they wanting to achieve the ultimate goal shouldn't be the goal. And then the second one is, we keep saying, I'm better at these things, but there is no I. So what is it, the mind that is having the fetters?
That's the question. Yes.
Little recap.
The confusion about having to use the language of I hear, I see, I smell, I, and there's, you know, even in the loving kindness, may I be happy, may I, you know, so we use the first person narrative because that's how we talk. And it gets real creepy if you start talking about yourself in the third person. And you see how I give the instructions with a little less your mind, your body, the mind. You know, so there is a shift from my mind to the mind. But you don't want to use that too much in conversation. Because it's just weird if you start saying like, the mind was thinking. So in meditation investigation, you can start to try to reframe it as rather than I, me, mine, to like, this is what this body, the body is experiencing, or the ears, or the mind, or the nose, or so in your own internal. But then when we communicate, and especially, you know, in teachings, we have to say I when we're communicating with each other. It's the belief in a permanent I that is the problem, not the use of the language. And the Buddha was asked this question because, you know, it's a normal question. You know, the Buddha's saying, hey, there's no permanent self here. And he's saying, like, why do you keep saying I? He said, because it's like just how we communicate. You have to use it. You just don't believe it. You got to say it, just don't believe it. And some people say, like, you know, you wear it more like a loose garment, the self, rather than pretending like there is none. Or, you know, we still have our personality. We still have our views and opinions. It's just what I was trying to say before of like just a bit more humility of like, I could probably, you know, I might be wrong, rather than always convinced that we're right and that our views and our opinions and our perspectives are true. So that little bit loosening up with what the mind is telling us, what the ego is telling us, and having a bit more healthy skepticism of our own narrative. But yeah, it's a little bit confusing. Maybe it's meant to be, maybe it's inevitable that it is. I don't know. I haven't, don't try to fit, you know, I don't try to figure it out that much. I don't rest in no self all of the time. I'm quite honest about most of the time. I'm thinking like, yep, this is me, my body, but trying to meditate on like, it's just a body. It's the human condition. Almost always convinced that my opinions are the right ones, but then kind of stepping back and being like, it's just an opinion, just a view. And it can get even stickier when you like get like, this is what the Buddha taught. this is the truth. And you're going to get real attached to the views and the opinions. And, you know, and if you don't believe it, you're wrong. Rather than just like, yeah, it seems like this is what the Buddha taught. Mostly makes sense to me. I got some questions. I'm going to sit with them. Rather than like, I'm going to fucking fight you because you don't agree. Please, Ryan.
Just like as a practical application, we were talking about sound, you know, and about especially like horns and like leaf blowers and like holy fuck in LA mechanized noise.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I like the idea, like, me coming to Buddhism has like given me a long list of things that aren't my fault, and that has been so beautiful. You know, to just like forgive myself and like just allow this to like, okay, like relate to the human experience in a brand new way. But like I really struggle with that, with like that sound, like that almost like PTSD kind of aversion that comes up. And I probably know where you're gonna go with this, but in that moment, like applying mindfulness when that fetter arises, you know, like what does that look like? That process of like just, oh, it's there, just okay, so what?
I feel like the first step is putting a lot of attention. Let me repeat. Could you hear at home? The question was around like particularly with unpleasant sounds and that almost immediate aversion that comes up around it. And what's the practice? Put a lot of attention on the feeling tone. So just first name hearing unpleasant. Sometimes just naming unpleasant rather than I hate that sound. Just hearing unpleasant, and then you can have that, you know, you can sit with the aversion to like, I find the leaf blowers or the traffic or the construction sounds or whatever it is really unpleasant. But coming back to like, it's just hearing. And there can be some investigation of like, well, who's hearing? Who's so aversive to this? What is it about the nails on the chalkboard that are so jarring? It's just the body reacting to a loud sound. And it can be some PTSD, some survival something. I think it's really interesting for all of us to investigate why we are so judgmental about man-made sounds. Because like when you're at the beach, you're not pissed off at the waves. When you're out in the desert or in the woods or whatever, and the fucking birds won't shut the fuck up. Or the wind in the trees, or right? Like there's some loud sounds out there in nature. I tell them to shut the fuck up sometimes. I can get aversive to nature sounds, but human-made sounds, we really feel like people are doing something wrong.
The whole story.
It's a whole story and judgment and this kind of humans aren't part of nature. There's all of the teachings earlier in this around the four elements. We're just the four elements. Everything's just the four elements. Every person is just the four elements. And, you know, yes, we have concrete and we have motors and we have, you know, all of these things, but also those are just the four elements. The motor is made out of the four elements. The concrete is the four elements. It's all nature. And this idea that humans are somehow separate and we're destroying nature. We are, but it's nature destroying nature. Humans are also just, you know, fucking some fungus that this planet gave birth to. We're fucking it up, you know, we're smothering it with our fungus and our technology and all of that's true, but we are also nature, right? Like we came from whatever biological evolution happened. Yes, just let go. But then you can't just let go. So then just have the humility to be like, oh, suffering. Name it. First noble truth. Like last week we were talking about, You know, okay, here's unpleasant sound. I'm aversive to it. Yes, just let go. Can't let go. Okay, suffering about it feels like this. Mindfulness of this is dukkha. My anger, my, you know, entitlement to peaceful environments, all of that, you know, that's coming up. Suffering. Please.
I was just going to say that if it is beyond just the visceral response, it actually is a rage trigger, and it is more like misophonia, which is a condition, then breath work, I found, is the only way to sort of deal with the rage. And some of the stuff we do here does help to sort of acknowledge the feelings and realize that the person, for me, it's people noises that trigger, and realize that the people aren't doing it to me. I don't know if you can do that with traffic, but.
But they could shut their mouth while they're chewing.
They could, but I can't control it. I have been known to tell people stop breathing.
Yeah. You have to breathe so loud.
Can you please stop breathing?
Does the breath work use basically as like a concentration, like a distraction?
Yeah.
So that it's, you're just not so focused on the sound and you give your attention to something else. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Skillful to be able to shift your attention in that way.
Doesn't always work,
yeah. So I'll end with this. In the time of the Buddha, there was a holy man named Bahiya of the bark cloth. Bahiya of the bark cloth, you know, that this is like when you make your own clothes out of bark, and you know, is one of the sadhus, one of the, and he was a very good meditator and sort of a lot of people thought he was enlightened, and he had a little humility. He's like, I'm not sure if I'm enlightened or not, but I heard about this Buddha guy and I'm gonna go check with the Buddha whether or not I'm enlightened. He had some doubt. He didn't have total confidence, and he's like, let me check out my views and my, you know, experience based on what the enlightened Buddha's teachings are. And so he travels a distance, and he has this kind of urgency. He's like, I got to meet the Buddha. And he finally finds the Buddha, but he finds the Buddha at like 11 a.m. and the Buddha is on his alms round. And, you know, and the Buddhas can only eat, like monks, and the Buddha had this rule of you can only eat before noon. And you can't eat anything you can only eat between sunrise and midday. Anything after midday, you can't have any food until the next day sunrise. So he was going out for his daily meal, and Bahiya finds him and says, you know, Buddha, like I need some teachings. I need to, you know, and the Buddha says, like, I'm going out to lunch right now. I'm a little bit busy. You know, come back later. But Bahiya is insistent. He says, no, like, it's urgent. I need to know now. And so the Buddha says, no, a second time. But, you know, and then there's the way the story goes. Anyways, he asks him the third time. And if he asks him, the Buddha, three times in a row, the Buddha has to say, okay, let me give you a quickie. give you a quickie. And so he says, okay, Bahiya, in brief, here is my teaching. There is only seeing and what is seen. There is only hearing and what is heard. There is only smelling and what is smelt. Only tasting and what is tasted. There is only thoughts, all right, and sensations, and thoughts and sensations being known. And can I go to lunch now? And the Bahiya, the spotless, immaculate eye of the Dharma arises, and he says, I get it. There's nobody receiving this. It's just the mind and body experiencing themselves. There's no permanent fixed self. Gets it, and he's liberated. And the Buddha goes off to lunch, and Bahiya starts to walk away. And then this feral cow starts trampling down the pathway, and he runs over and murders Bahiya. And Bahia dies a fully enlightened arahant. And he, because, you know, the story is, oh, you get it. Shouldn't over-explain the joke, right? The urgency, you know, that all that urgency that he felt of like, I really need to, and that he got it, and that he was actually that, don't wait, don't postpone, like try to get the teachings now, do the practice now. And this teaching of the sense doors was the teaching that the Buddha gave to Bahia in this very concise way. It's just sound. There's no self hearing it. It's just the body hearing, just seeing, just smelling, it's just tasting. Stop taking it all. Stop being so fucking self-centered about all of it. Stop clinging to it. Stop shackling yourself to what you're hearing and seeing and smelling and tasting and thinking and your views and opinions. Stop shackling yourself to your mind. Set yourself free. Easier said than done. That's for sure. We'll end with that tonight. Welcome to the new people. Good to see everybody. A few announcements. First off, Against the Stream is a nonprofit organization that is fully supported by your generosity. Everyone's welcome, you know, regardless of ability to donate, but your donations are what allow us to pay the rent here, to support the employee. And then if there are some extra, gives me some salary, pays me some livelihood. Couple ways to do that. You can donate when you drop in. You can donate when you come through Zoom and make a, you know, donation when you come. Thank you in advance for doing that, whatever your donations are. You can become a monthly supporter. You can say, hey, I want to support Against the Stream. I want to be part of this thing continuing. So you can become a monthly supporter on the website. There's a few different options, $25, $50, $100 a month, just to support the organization. I have a day-long retreat on April 6th coming up, where we'll do a 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. day of sitting meditation and walking meditation and sitting meditation and walking meditation. So you're all invited, and gets $65 registration fee for that. Anybody who can't afford it is welcome to come as a scholarship or pay what you can. Everybody's welcome. So just register for that or let us know, and we'll put you on the list for it. There's a few spaces left in the weekend retreat in May. We have a two-day retreat here in Los Angeles on the east side, Friday, Saturday, Sunday weekend retreat, May 10th through 12th. I have scheduled, but we haven't opened for registration yet, the nine-day fall retreat, which we will have. It's the end of September. So I think it's September 24th through October 3rd, nine nights, 10-day silent meditation retreat. Through Against the Stream in the fall. And there's a bunch of refuge recovery retreats that I'm also teaching. This weekend we're going to Oregon, but that's already full. We don't want any late registrations for that. Next month in April, I'm going to Texas. If you know any homies in Texas, I think it's somewhere between Austin and Houston, like an hour and a half from Austin, hour from Houston. This retreat center, I think it's called Chapel Hill, Texas. 3-day refuge recovery, silent meditation retreat. And that India trip is happening. I'm registering people for the India pilgrimage. We're gonna do 11 or 12 days together in India, November 13th through 24th. So I'm registering that through Refuge Recovery. It is going to be a refuge recovery pilgrimage. But as long as you're willing to live by the precepts and be fully sober during the trip, other people who aren't in refuge are also welcome to come on that India trip. And a bunch of people have already registered. If you're planning to come, it's definitely going to fill up probably sooner rather than later. But think about coming to India with me in November. It's going to be a cool trip. We're going to a little more than half the time be on a train where that's going to take us to the different pilgrimage spots around India on this kind of cool sleeper private Buddhist pilgrimage sleeper train thing we're going to go on. It's going to be cool.
Is that on the website?
It's on the Refuge Recovery website. Yeah, it's open for reg now. What am I forgetting, Sebastian? I got it?
Yes.
May any goodness that comes from our practice be gathered and shared with each other. Using the sound of the Harley Davidson as a mindfulness. Sharing this merit outward in all directions. May we each get as free as possible. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.